KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Happy Thanksgiving Day. In this pre-recorded hour on Forum, we talk with celebrated author Philip Roth, who joins us to talk about his new novel, Indignation, which is set against the backdrop of the Korean War. And it tells the story of a New Jersey good boy who goes off to college in southern Ohio and must deal with an increasingly neurotic father and increasingly dramatic difficulties in his own life. That's up ahead with Philip Roth. Happy Thanksgiving. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Once again, we are pleased to have with us in this pre-recorded forum hour the distinguished American novelist Philip Roth, whose 29th book, Indignation, takes us back to the era of the Korean War and the adventures and misadventures of a young New Jersey boy named Marcus Meisner, who is the son of a kosher butcher father who has inexplicably gone mad in fear and overzealous protectiveness toward his beloved son. His obsessions drive Marcus to a southern Ohio college, where he is exposed to a Midwest WASP American culture that brings dramatic changes to his young life. Philip Roth won the Pulitzer Prize in 1997 for American Pastoral and has twice won the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award, as well as being the three-time recipient of the Penn Faulkner Award. In 1998, he received the National Medal of Arts at the White House, and in 2002, the Gold Medal in Fiction, the highest award of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He is the only living American writer to have his work published in a comprehensive, definitive edition by the Library of Congress, and he joins us for this pre-recorded hour, and delighted to have you.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Well, let's begin by talking about the last two times you were with us when we spoke about Exit Ghost and Everyman, certainly novels about aging and septuagenarianism, and now you've gone back to youth, to a narrator who is young, and shifted in that sense, and also shifted back to the Midwest, we ought to note, because your first book, well, Ron Potemkin was in Columbus, Ohio, and it was about Columbus, Ohio. So we're back to the Midwest, and we're back to youth, and we're back to the Korean War as well. All of these are significant.
Yeah, well, it was a deliberate choice, just because I have spent the last 4 or 5 years writing books about older men, their experience, their problems, their aging, and so on. And when I finished Exit Ghost, I had had enough of that. And so I wanted to write about a young man, but I also wanted to write about another period. And in looking back over my other books and looking back over my life, I realized that one of the periods of historical periods that I've lived through that I had never really attended to in fiction was the period of the Korean War, which began in June of 1950 and lasted for 3 years. And I myself started college just about 2 months after it began. I started in September of 1950. So the backdrop to my college years was the Korean War and the prospect of entering that war once I graduated.
Often called the Forgotten War, of course.
Yes, yes.
And was it invigorating to write again from the voice of a youth or in the voice of a young man and what his life was like with it being ahead of him and all that?
It was new again, and it was invigorating. In order to prepare myself, I really began with the period. I didn't begin with the young man; that came second, really. I began with that Korean War period, hoping that as I read about it, and I read 9 or 10 books, and as I read about it, that something, some story, some necessary story would come to my mind. And there are many stories that could come to mind, and someone else would have come up with something else, but I came up with this one.
Well, you also have a kind of tribute in a way, because the college he goes to is Winesburg College, and one immediately thinks of Sherwood Anderson. Even the name of the newspaper is the Eagle, which is the name of George Willard's newspaper, and you have the Willard House there. All of these kind of tips of the hat to Sherwood Anderson. Was there anything more deliberate in including Winesburg, Ohio here?
Well, it's a book I admired, one of the first books I admired when I was old enough to know what books were, and I still admire it. And I was rereading it only probably about 18 months ago, just before I started writing this book. And I thought that if there was a college in the town of Winesburg, as Anderson describes Winesburg, which is as a claustrophobic place in which the moral prohibitions are very strict and the secrets of the citizens are grotesque, is his word, that if there was a college in that Winesburg, Ohio, that he imagined, it would be the college that I wanted to imagine. So I took the name from him, and it was great fun writing Winesburg down over and over again and writing the book.
Well, speaking of moral prohibitions being very strict, this is another good boy in the ongoing Philip Roth oeuvre of good boys and bad boys. He wants to be a valedictorian. He listens to his mother. We'll talk about his relationship with his father. But he becomes rebellious in spite of himself and becomes rebellious to really some moral issues or moral rules that are imposed upon him. That's really at least one of the major sources of his indignation.
Mm. Well, to bring his father into it, he falls under surveillance, heavy surveillance in his home. His first year of college is spent at home. He goes to a little local college, and because the family doesn't have much money. And everything is fine. He rather likes the place. But what he notices very quickly is that as he achieves his young maturity, his father becomes more and more uneasy about him. Because he has the independence of a young man. And though he is, as you say, a good boy, an obedient and dutiful son, his father is wildly frightened that something untoward is going to happen to his boy. And so Marcus leaves home and goes to college, and then at the college he discovers himself under the surveillance of its authorities.
Under surveillance and also under, well, moral prescriptions. He mm-hmm. has to attend chapel. I mean, I went to school a little after this, about a decade after, but in southern Ohio, and those rules were there, just as the rules that you bring into the novel of co-eds having to sign in and sign out. I mean, this is something medieval when you explain it to young people today, but those were indeed the way the mores existed.
Mm. Well, that's what I wanted to do in a way. One of my goals was to explain it to young people today. Through this book, because it's incomprehensible to them that the freedoms that came as a result of the battles of the 60s, the social battles of the 60s, gave these kids as their inheritance, the kids today, moral freedom and sexual freedom and a general loosening of boundaries that was unheard of in the 1950s. And I wanted to write about those old social norms, those old ethical norms, which we took for granted. We thought this was the way the world was. I don't think I experienced it, or nor did the friends of mine, as prohibitive or repressive. It was just in the nature of things. Only, I think, from the perspective of the post-60s does one look back on it and see just how excruciatingly repressive it was.
It's also hard sometimes, I find, for young people, for example, to even conceive that there were fraternities, as you write about, that had prohibitions against taking Jews, blacks, of course, as well, but Jews, too, that mm-hmm. divorce was such a strong taboo that, well, in your story, Epstein, I remember it was portrayed as being something that, you know, good middle-class Jewish people didn't do. But here again, you know, it's something that just is unthinkable almost.
Well, yeah, I wanted to bring that world to life, that's what came out of my cogitating the Korean War moment was what was the social atmosphere, what was the moral atmosphere of the time, and I wanted to depict that through the adventures of this kid.
It's also through the kids in the campus because, without giving the plot away, there is a melee that takes place that seems to come out of the young people's sexual repression to a great degree. And, in fact, the president of the college has a great deal of indignation toward these youth and for the way they misbehave.
Well, all the men in this book are vessels of indignation. The president of the college, the dean of the college, Marcus, the hero of the book, his father, and so on. So there's not a man who's untouched by indignation.
You talk about Marcus as a hero. I mean, can we explore that a bit? What is heroic to him about you, as far as you're concerned?
I didn't mean hero in the sense of heroic. I meant hero in terms of being the protagonist of the book. He is, if not heroic, distinguished by his determination and stubbornness. It's also his fatal flaw, especially in a long argument he has with the dean when he objects to going to attend a chapel, which in this college you had to attend 40, F-O-R-T-Y, 40 times to graduate. And he objects not because he's a Jew and the chapel takes place in a church and it has Christian overtones, but he objects because he's an ardent, passionate atheist modeling himself on the moral philosopher Bertrand Russell.
I must tell you, just one of those strange serendipitous things that I was writing about that essay by Bertrand Russell and then sat down and picked up your book where I had left off, and suddenly I have Marcus quoting that essay in the dean's office. I mean, when those things happen, one doesn't know what to make of them, but that's exactly what
writing,
happened.
Why were you writing about that essay?
Well, because I fancy I'm writing a book now about theology and metaphysics and all of that, and faith, really. I'm in the midst of that, but it was just one of those odd, almost inexplicable, no, not almost, inexplicable coincidences that made me feel peculiar.
It's a powerful essay, that essay of Bertrand
Russell. Wonderful essay. Yeah. I mean, particularly in that it has all of his passion. And as you point out in the novel, the dean, who is, you know, a man of high moral standards for the day and of deep religious belief and who's very much admired for his former athletic history and prowess, you know, he looks upon Russell as probably people would have in his position as being, you know, a moral reprobate, really.
Absolutely, yeah.
Notice, for example, that you said that as you've gotten older, you see history more clearly. Certainly that was true in The Plot Against America. That's true here. Talk about that.
Well, I can look back over a span of years in a way I couldn't when I was younger. If you could contrast Goodbye Columbus to this book, they're both about young men. They're both about young men in college or just out of college from the same, more or less the same social background. But when I wrote Goodbye Columbus, I was myself in my 20s, and I didn't see the historical backdrop as even present. I wasn't conscious of it, though it was there, and it was determining my life as much as any other time was going to. Only now, some 50 years on of since writing that book, do I see this young fellow's story against the backdrop of history. And this is just the perspective one is I've now achieved.
But the story in Goodbye Columbus, Defender of the Faith, the story that caused a lot of controversy, is a story that uses World War II as a backdrop and makes it vivid in a historical context.
Well, I wasn't dumb to it, you know, but I've become much more aware of it, and it's much more useful to me when I'm at work. It seems to feed my imagination now as it didn't then.
Let's talk again about the father-son relationship, because it's so integral to this novel and so important. And, you know, it's I found myself, on the one hand, being a little bemused at the idea of being afraid of pool halls, which also speaks to the time. And Music Man and all starts with a P and rhymes with T, and that stands for pool type of thing. But there's also just a kind of almost, well, it's a madness and paranoia that comes over this father, and it's just fear. Has to do, of course, with his own relatives and what happened to them in the war, but it just seems to overwhelm him because the son and the father have this wonderful, loving relationship.
Well, the father is transformed. I think these things happen between parents and children when the children grow, not necessarily that specific thing, but transformations occur. And parents can become frightened of children as they get older, too. In this case, he doesn't become frightened of him. He becomes fearful for him. And he has a gigantic, the father, has a gigantic premonition that something terrible is going to befall his son. He can't name it, but he's fearful of virtually every activity his boy engages in because of the horror of some accident occurring that will kill his son or maim him or something awful. And I was thinking when I was writing the book that he's like a character in a fable or a fairy tale who has a premonition. And it's beyond psychologizing. That is, it just comes over him and takes hold of him, and this fear becomes his ruling passion and drives the son crazy.
And becomes prescient.
Yes, and that's what I wanted, too. Turns out that this thing that seems almost comic in its paranoia is prophetic, and that what he fears for the boy happens through a series of small, freakish choices or accidents, really.
Can we talk about the choice that you made without spoiling the plot? A very daring choice as far as the boy and from whence he's speaking or from where he's speaking?
Well, yeah, sure. We can talk about the fact that, to go back to the chapel business, he goes dutifully to chapel, loathing it every time he goes to it. And he discovers it, in fact, he discovers from other students that you don't have to go. You can just pay somebody to go for you, and they can sign your name, and that's that. That's in violation of the college's rules, but he hates chapel so, even though he's law-abiding, he decides to do it, and the repercussions are terrible. They're not just a small punishment that follows.
When I say you were taking a chance, though, you have him talking to us, from eternity.
I'm hesitant to say it, Michael. It's okay. It's still okay to say it in America.
Thank you. But, you know, I really admired this. I thought it was very daring on your part to have someone talking to us from beyond the grave. I noticed one reviewer thought he was really in comatose state and you didn't intend to have him from beyond the grave. But I thought that intention was pretty clear. And I thought maybe this is also what Philip Roth conceives eternity to be like. I mean, that sense of just being mined and just having to judge all of your actions through memory that goes on eternally.
No, it isn't what I haven't got a clue about eternity. My sneaking suspicion is that there's nothing awaiting us. Speaks from what he thinks is death. And that occurs early in the narration, really, that he sees himself as being dead, and that death is just remembering your life in all its minutiae.
Yes, I was prompted because Norman Mailer told me in an interview that he really did think that maybe what survived us in an afterlife was just memory or something along memory that would stay intact in some way that we can't conceive, obviously.
Well, Norman's now in a position to know.
Yeah, well, if he can talk to us like Harry Houdini, we can get some enlightenment on that
score. If anybody can talk to us from beyond, it's Norman Mailer.
Talking to Philip Roth, his new book is Indignation in this pre-recorded hour. And those who remember Portnoy's complaint, remember the strong mother and all of the all the sensation that caused. Here is a strong mother in this novel who is loving and who is strong in ways that don't necessarily induce guilt, although she does extract a promise out of her son. But again, a very different kind of mother and ultimately strong in the sense of running a butcher shop and doing all of those things that have to do with hard work in a butcher shop as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I liked inventing her. She was drawn in part on some the mother of a friend of mine. I didn't know much about her life in detail, but physically she worked with her husband in a butcher shop, and so I modeled her on this woman who I knew when I was a kid.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about the butcher shop and a lot of sense palpably for a reader about what goes on in a butcher shop. I mean, just the blood and the eviscerating and
yes.
all
well,
of that.
My closest friend when I was in college was the son of this mother. And he worked for his father in the butcher shop and delivered orders in the truck, and I sometimes went with him. But I also had to visit some butcher shops find out some more, so I went over to Brooklyn, where they still have kosher butcher shops, and they haven't changed much since 1940. I was able to hang around. Nobody gave me a hard time, ask some questions, pick up the smells, and that's the best part of the job, is going to butcher shop.
There's a funny moment when the dean insists that Marcus should have put down kosher butcher shop when he
yes,
says father's
yes.
vocation as opposed to just butcher shop.
Yes. Well, it isn't anti-Semitism that Marcus smells, but he smells something. And it isn't that the dean is anti-Semitic. I didn't mean that. But it's just this kind of misunderstandings that can occur in conversation between any minority member and somebody who represents the great majority.
Well, he also hears the frat boy saying he thinks maybe Jew come here instead of you come here when he's waiting on their tables.
Yeah, well, so it's hard to distinguish that sometimes.
Again, talking with Philip Roth, his new book is Indignation. What do you say to those who love your work but say a lot of the great comedy has dissipated through the years or isn't as intact as it was, say, particularly in a shtick book like Portnoy?
Well, Portnoy's Complaint was one of a kind, but there have been other funny books. Great American Novel, I meant to be a funny book. Our Gang, I meant to be a funny book. In certain ways, The Breast is. And it's true that I myself have noticed it in the writing, that the books are more serious, more dour, some of them, more pessimistic. I don't know how to account for it. I think my attitude in life is pretty much what it always was, just as hopeful as it always was. But I think my imagination is running in a certain direction, and I'm mining a certain vein that I didn't when I was younger, and it must have to do with age and time passing.
And mortality, huh?
Good old mortality.
Good old mortality. I mean, this is in many ways a tragic book, obviously. And the last few have been.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it ends tragically. Well, I wanted that. I was interested in that in the father's fear. And didn't want to make him just a foolish, fearful old man. I didn't want to make him foolish at all. Even though he may appear to be foolish in the beginning of the book, I wanted that premonition he had to work itself out. And my job in writing the book was to work it out persuasively and not arbitrarily.
Again, if you've just joined us, this is a pre-recorded hour of Forum. We're talking to novelist and short story writer and essayist and distinguished writer who has probably received every award extant except the Nobel, which may come his way as well, Philip Roth. His newest book is called Indignation, and we will return after a brief break. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum, a pre-recorded hour with author Philip Roth. His newest novel is called Indignation, which takes place in the 50s, around the time of the Korean War, when there was conscription. There was, of course, during Vietnam and the Vietnam War as well. But we were talking in the last segment about how strange things appear to young people when you talk about this era, because the customs and the mores have changed so much. And one of the things that occurred to me along those lines, Philip, was... Well, I want to talk with you about the young woman, Olivia, the love interest of Marcus. He is a virgin, and he is shocked when, we'll try to clean this up as best we can, when she performs oral sex, because in those days that was even sometimes a lot more shocking than intercourse, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, it was unknown to most of us in that era who were growing up in that era, and when she does reward him with this this sexual favor, he's shocked. He, rather than delighting in it or returning the favor, he's bewildered. And this is not a dopey kid and not really an innocent boy for his era. He's as worldly as one might expect someone to be of that age, 19 or 20, whatever he is. 19, I guess. And he doesn't know what to do about it, and he's alarmed. He's alarmed as well. Because what does it mean about the girl? She's a highly intelligent, very attractive young woman who he saw in met in one of his classes and saw one night in the library, and took her on a date. And the conclusion of the date is that there's this sexual eureka, and I wanted to have incorporated in his response the very nature of the taboos of the era. That is, that he not only is he bewildered and uncertain about who she is, but he doesn't even want to see her again. Yet he's fallen for her, so he's caught in a trap of being frightened, as it were, of the sexual act, and yet falling for the girl.
I want to talk about the girl with you, though I couldn't help thinking at one point, particularly when he's in Dean Caldwell's office, saying, I did not have intercourse with that woman or that girl. were you thinking of Clinton? Or was...
No, I didn't until just this moment when you speak of it. But, of course, that was the situation. But Clinton was another kettle of fish.
But she is disturbed in some ways, mm-hmm. and has a history that we find out that has to do with... electroshock, and again, I don't want to give out too many details here, but there's a sense that that in spite of her, well, disturbances, or maybe even because of them, he's really drawn to. Which is it?
Well, he's ambivalent about her disturbances. She's been in, I think it's Menninger Clinic, and she has had electroshock treatments, and she has had a history of breakdowns. And he's not sure whether that's heroic and something he can allow himself to be drawn to, or whether it's catastrophic and it's something he should be in flight from. And because she has great charm as well as considerable beauty and high intelligence, and she's utterly desirable, except that she has a scar on her wrist from where she tried to cut her wrist. So he doesn't know what to do about her.
And yet, as I said, I think it's fair to say, even though he's only a 19-year-old boy and in the flush of what amounts to a first deep emotional attachment, falls in love with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he falls in love with her. She would appear with him. And then his mother comes to visit because he has his appendix removed, an emergency procedure, goes into the hospital. His mother comes out to visit him. She meets the young woman, and she sees the scar on her wrist. It's she slit one wrist, not both. But as the mother says, he says to her at one point, she only slit one wrist. He said, my mother says, we only have two. So one is 50%, you know. And then consequences follow.
She... appears to be, it's a class thing again. I mean, she comes from a wealthy Cleveland background, daughter of a doctor. He's, you know, lower middle class, son of a butcher. And what you have going in this novel, which I found as a boy who grew up in Ohio, very compelling, is that sense not only of a different era, but of a different regional culture of the Midwest and how different it is. I mean, there's the class difference, as I said, between Olivia mm-hmm. and Marcus, but there's also this real chasm that exists between, well, Marcus growing up in New Jersey, and say, for example, one of his roommates, Elwin, the guy with the 1940 mm-hmm. LaSalle, mm-hmm. one of these typical kind of reticent Midwestern guys, and you capture that quite well.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, well, he is out of his element there. He wanted to be out of his element. That's why he went there. He wanted to be in that typical American little college. He fell in love with the picture on the front of the catalog, bulletin or catalog of the college, and was attracted to the college because of that. So he is in a world where the customs are new to him, and the human types, as you say, speaking about Elwin, his roommate, the human types are new to him too. It's his first exposure to a world other than the world of home, really.
He also has as another roommate before Elwin is his roommate, a misanthropic character named Bert Flusser, who is quite mocking, but is also gay. And I didn't know if you were trying to show the difficulty, I mean, if there was something political about that portrayal, or just, you know, here's a portrayal of someone who happened to be gay in this era.
Well, yeah, because Marcus, as he says, he didn't know that homosexuality existed. Or he knew it existed but didn't believe it, and which I think is a truthful depiction, again, of young people in that era. So Flusser is, he doesn't even know Flusser is homosexual, which is the word we used at that time, and only discovers near the end. But Flusser drives him crazy because he's a kind of he's the college bohemian, isn't he?
The man who identifies with Malvolio.
Yes, identifies with Malvolio. I'll take revenge on all of you, yeah.
And certainly a character whom, well, we're not meant to sympathize with, clearly, are we?
Well, he's enjoyable from the outside, I think. I don't know whether you sympathize with him. I can never answer that question about my own characters.
Well, you sympathize with most of them, I believe, don't you? Even somebody like Mickey Sabbath, I have a feeling you probably sympathize with.
But I sympathize with all of them. That's, I sympathize with the dean and the president of the university. It was great fun writing the president's harangue to the students after the gigantic panty raid.
Well, there are some characters that I suspect you don't sympathize with. You know, some of the bête noirs of your protagonists. The other Philip Roth in the Shylock Operation character.
Oh, but I got a big kick out of him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that my sympathy comes out in that way, which is I get a kind of delight out of making them up.
It seemed like you were delighted in making up this character, Sonny Kotler, who's so good-looking that he almost defies evolution.
Yes. I did get a kick out of making him up. He's that you always run into one or two when you're in college, which is the perfect boy. A boy who's the super good-looking and a super athlete and super with the girls and makes you into kind of a loathsome creature by comparison.
And speaking about evolution, I was noticing in reading your book, since evolution abhors unclimactic petting, the prevailing sexual code could be physically excruciating. You're getting here at something that I think is probably no longer acceptable, an alliterative phrase about what would happen to young boys at the time.
Testicular pain.
Okay, good. I think that's a very good clinical way to describe it. Again, out of another era, really, I suspect.
Oh, it's unknown. The last case of testicular pain in America was probably about 30 years ago. I think it's gone out with measles, you know.
Again, we're talking with Philip Roth, and we're talking about his new novel, Indignation, which takes place in the Korean War. Were you thinking about analogs to the Iraq War?
No.
Not at all.
No, I was thinking about then trying to make persuasive my picture of what things were like then when you had the draft. Actually, the Korean War draft was just an extension of the draft that had been initiated in just before World War II. The first draft began, I think, in 1940, and it ran through 1945. but it didn't stop when World War II ended. So when the Korean War began in 1950, the same draft was in place, and everybody was drafted for 2 years. And if you were in college, you got a deferment. But then the day you left college, you were gobbled up. And the Korean War was particularly brutal, or it was brutal in its own particular way, and savage and frightening. And it was the backdrop to my, as I say, to my own college years. And it was frightening to think that when I graduated from college, I was going to graduate into the military. As it happened, the war ended the year before I left college.
No, we were fighting communists, as we were in Vietnam, I guess, at least in the minds of most of those who propagandized for the war. And a couple of things struck me along those lines. Your use of the Chinese national anthem, or the People's Republic national anthem, it plays a key role in this novel.
Yeah, well, you know, it's strange. I wrote that book about a year ago. And just about a month ago, when the Olympics were on, we all heard that song, the Chinese national anthem, 70 or 80 times, as it was played whenever the Chinese won a gold medal. That's the same song I have in my book. I learned it, like my young hero, as a grade school kid. I was in grade school during World War II, and once a week we had an assembly program, and all the kids came into this auditorium, and we sang patriotic songs to keep our morale up and to make little patriots of us. And we sang the Caissons Go Rolling Along, the Army song, and Anchors Away, the Navy song, and so on. And the song of the Marine Corps, The Halls of Montezuma. And we did it very rousingly, poured all our little souls into it. And we also sang a song that we were told was the Chinese national anthem. But we had rather left-leaning faculty in the grade school I went to, and it was really the Chinese communist song, marching song. And it wasn't the song of Chiang Kai-shek's China. And so we would hear these little Jewish kids were belting out, "Arise, ye who refuse to be bond slaves," and singing this Chinese communist song in Newark, New Jersey. And then when the communist China came into existence as a state, they took this as their song. But it has great weight with Marcus because it has the word indignation in it. Indignation fills the hearts of all of our countrymen. And the word indignation is what fires him up in his attempt to maintain his autonomy at Winesburg College.
Followed by "Arise, arise, arise," yeah.
Yes, arise, arise, arise.
And I was also struck by the epigram you selected from "I Sing of Olaf, Glad and Big." I mean, that's really the indignation. That's Marcus again. You know, I can't use the word again. This is FCC codes and everything. But Olaf, upon what were once knees, does almost ceaselessly repeat. There is some blank I will not eat. That summarizes it in many ways for Marcus in terms of indignation, doesn't it?
E. Cummings is a very mixed bag of poetry, as you know. He can be quite wonderful, as he is in that Olaf poem. And then he can be sort of just a little frothy and light and not so great. But that's a wonderful poem of his, "I Sing of Olaf." And there, further on, there's another few lines we also can't repeat. So they produce, he's a conscientious objector, and he's being tormented and tortured for his political position. And they present him with a flag, and he says, "I will not kiss your effing flag," which is another good line in the poem.
Also,
so I thought it was appropriate to Marcus's story.
Yeah, I thought it was as well. I also wanted to ask you, getting back to the Korean War for the moment, you felt it important, I presume, to mention that these machine guns that were used against Americans were Russian-made?
Mm-hmm. They were. Yeah. Well, I was trying to give a little crash course in the Korean War to the reader as smoothly and spontaneously as I could without it seeming like needless exposition or history lesson. And so, yeah, I didn't include that fact. They were Russian made.
And there's also the sense that that Marcus, and I feel comfortable calling him a hero, not necessarily synonymous with protagonist, because he stands up for himself and he will not take, or he'll be indignant against taking blank. But you get the sense of what has he understood in this? I mean, at one point later on, I didn't understand Elwin, I didn't understand Flusser, I didn't understand my father. In fact, he said, "No one and nothing did I understand." I mean, I guess to the reader to understand, but one's heart goes out to him, mind it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, at that stage of the game, not to mention later, you're bombarded by new events, brand new conflicts, brand new ambiguities, and you behave according to your principles in a kind of state of unknowing, and that's what I try. That's how I try to present him.
Did you want us to see him as, again, someone who tried to live by principles, who tried to be virtuous to the best of his ability? Because that comes across.
Yeah, well, yes, he can't help it. That's who he is.
That's who he is, yeah. Also, couldn't help thinking just about, we know from conversations we've had before that we're both big admirers of Sal Bellow and his work, and in Seize the Day, there's a character who slaughters chickens, thousands and thousands of chickens, named Rappaport. And you get the feeling that there's something about this world of animal slaughter and butcher shops and slaughterhouses and so forth that that curiously ties in with war and becomes metaphorically connected to war.
Well, there's plenty of blood in the book, but a lot of the blood flows in a butcher shop and is... as it were, innocuous, except that Marcus has a visceral response to it. I mean, he doesn't mind working in the butcher shop. In fact, he rather likes working next to his father because of the camaraderie that develops. But he can never really get himself used to the blood, and he knows how sharp is because he knows what these knives can do, and sometimes when he's thinking about the war, He thinks about the knives they use in the butcher shop. Mostly what interested me was what always interests me about these occupations that I saw around me when I was a kid is the details of them. I'm sort of fascinated by how these operations work. I have a leather factory in American Pastoral, and I have a jewelry shop in Everyman, and I haven't done a candy store yet, but maybe the next book.
Yeah, I remember in Everyman we talked about the detail of jewelry as well as the advertising world.
That's right, yes.
In that novel. And you do feel that you're in that, maybe from whatever you assimilated going to Brooklyn butcher shops, that you're there and understand what the world of... butcher shops is actually all about. It's also, by the way, talking about chickens being eviscerated and everything, we were talking a little while ago about how some of your humor has receded maybe through the years, but there's a joke that I recognized in here about how, you know, a woman in the butcher shop inspecting a chicken.
Oh, yes, that's good. Oh, I think there are funny moments in the book, and Marcus amuses Olivia once when she comes to visit him in the hospital after he's had his appendix removed, because she wants to know all she can about what is it like to be a butcher's son. She herself is a doctor's daughter. And he tells her some funny stories from the butcher shop, and I thought they were funny when I wrote them. And the one about Big Mendelsohn I particularly like.
You give Marcus's father this hacking cough, and it continues throughout the novel. And again, I don't want to give anything away, but it seemed to me an important detail in the sense that you call our attention to it, and then it turns out to be kind of another one of those twists of fate. It doesn't have anything to do with what happens ultimately to the father, but it's called to our attention again.
Well, you know, it was just that image that I liked of the father working in the butcher shop with the cigarette dangling out of the corner of his mouth all day. And I just wanted to include that, and I went from that to the cough and the fact the whole family smokes. It was just another fact from that era, really. It's a small detail, but it's the way you would see tradesmen, they were smoking all the time. You wouldn't see it at all now.
Talking again with Philip Roth, his new novel, his 29th book is Indignation. I always say that the most recent book is closest to, well, one's viscera, I guess. Do you have a hierarchy where your books are concerned? Is there, you know, because American Pastoral won the Pulitzer, does that represent somehow higher in your own pantheon, or how does that work?
Well, no. The prizes are nice to get, but I don't think they change one's assessment of one's own work. I sort of forget the books that I have written, and I find it very hard to reread them. I don't, unless I have to for some occasion, because every once in a while somebody invites me to, some friend who teaches invites me to a class because he's teaching Sabbath theater, so I have to look at it again and reread it so I can know what to say about it. But by and large, I don't turn back to books I've written in the past. And whatever prizes they may or may not have won doesn't really alter my my evaluation or my sense of the book.
It also seems that you, once the book turns into a movie, it's kind of like you let it go and you don't necessarily feel any necessity to tend to it. And in fact, some of the movies that have made of your books, you feel downright negative about.
Well, I have never really taken part in the making of any of these movies. I don't know that I've been asked to. I've been asked to read the scripts sometimes, but I don't do that either. I don't do that for two reasons. One is that I can't read a movie script. I can't make sense of it. I can't tell if a movie script is bad or good. That's number one. Number two is I don't want to be involved at all because the people who make movies live in a different world of literary perception and of literary values and so on. And I just don't have much in common with them. So if I decide to allow a movie to be made, I let the person who seems the most respectable and who has the best track record have it, and then I have nothing to do with it until I see a screening of it. And become properly indignant and
more indignation. Yeah.
Yes. That's the only place I get indignant these days.
Well, I confess that I saw, as probably many of my listeners did, Elegy Made from Dying Animal, which was another one of your novels that I liked very much. And I thought the movie was okay, but it had nothing to do with the novel, I mean, in any
mm-hmm.
real sense.
I agree with you.
Yeah. And Scott Rudin has commissioned this book, I understand. Is that right?
Yes, Scott Rudin has bought this book, and he's gotten, I just found the other day, Noah Baumbach to write it and direct it.
Uh-huh. That's promising, because he's mm-hmm. done some good work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's just one of your children you kind of have to let go, I guess. I think, in fact, they were afraid probably to use a dying animal for a movie. They thought, what would that do to box office?
That's true. They wouldn't put the words anywhere. They were frightened of the word dying.
So it became Elegy.
Or maybe they were frightened of the word animal. Yes, I don't know what it's an elegy for. Nobody dies, but...
You know, you're writing somewhat shorter novels, but we just did a program, in fact, with Tobias Wolff and a number of other people about the short story. And, in fact, I put out something with the teaching company on short story masterpieces, and so I've been very involved mm-hmm. in the short story. And you, like major figures in American literature, have moved through both genres, that is, through short fiction and novel with equal dexterity. But it seems like the short story is something that is behind you. Is that true?
I never was able to write short stories after I began. I began writing short stories, which was the natural thing to do back in the 50s. There were many, many places, as you remember, where you could publish a short story. There were 20, 25 little magazines, literary quarterlies, where if the story was any good, you could probably place it. That doesn't exist any longer. But that isn't why I don't write them. I began to write novels. I wrote, my first novel was Letting Go, and in 1962 it came out. And I liked the bigness. I liked the amplitude. I liked extending the story. I liked the complexity. I liked everything about it. So I may have written another story or two after that, but I just concentrated on writing novels, and usually novels longer certainly than this one. Now in the last three or four books, I've been writing these short novels, and it's just happened. In the beginning, I did it consciously. I wanted to see if I could figure out how you can make this pack a punch, how you can pack a punch in 50,000 words, you know. I've been always admired the short novels. I read a lot of them when I was younger, short novels of Thomas Mann, Death in Venice, and I think Tonio Kroger is a longish story, really. But Chekhov's Ward Number 6 and In the Ravine and so on, Kafka. I always loved the length. Now I seem to be doing it time after time. I really can't explain it. It's just fascinating. To see if you can pack a punch, if you can make this little thing into a fist, you know, and get something going.
Well, you managed to knock a lot of people out with your punches still and indignation. I loved. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Philip Roth, pre-recorded edition of Forum. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour's repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Sil Muller on controls this hour. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.